Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 312 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And in this podcast, we'll be continuing the rapid review series for the USMLE Step 2 CK exam. So this will be a rapid review series 56. And by the way, if you're taking the Step 3 exam, this rapid review series is a great series to listen to. Essentially, if you're studying for Step 3, all the Step 2 CK material essentially applies to you. So let's go ahead and jump right into it. So first, as a reminder, for those of you that are taking Step 2 CK Step 3 anytime soon, I do have an MBME Test Taking Strategies course coming up in about 11 days on the 25th of this month from 2 to 4:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. That's like 5 to 7:30 Eastern. And then I have a 20-hour super comprehensive review Step 2 CK Step 3 course coming up between the 26th and the 29th of this month. And again, that's going to be from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. If you're interested in signing up, just shoot me an email through the website and I'll give you some more information. But you will learn a ton from it. It's pretty comprehensive. We go over peds, surgery, IM, OB-GYN, psych, neuro, ethics, biostats, the changes from November of last year. And again, especially for a lot of the recent attendees for these courses, I've been getting a lot of really good feedback, not just in terms of quality of the course, but in terms of exam scores. People have been doing really, really well. I've had people that have had like 30, 40 point improvements from their step one score after, like, in terms of like real USMLE score after taking the course. So again, if you're interested, just shoot me an email through the website and I'll be more than happy to point you in the right direction. Okay, so let's jump right into it. So what if they give you a question about a 31-year-old female? They tell you that she has a history of type 1 diabetes. And then they tell you that, oh, over the last 2-3 weeks, let's say she just delivered a baby like 5 weeks ago. But that over the last 2-3 weeks, she has been having palpitations. And they tell you that on physical exam, she has hyperreflexia. And, she has like lid lag, right? And she's tachycardic. Her heart rate is really high. Her blood pressure is really high, right? They may even give you a calcium that is a little bit elevated. If you see all those things, what should you think about? Well, I would really hope you're saying, oh, Divine, this person likely has some kind of postpartum thyroiditis, right? So I know for some of you may be like, okay, Divine, how do you arrive at postpartum thyroiditis? And how do I differentiate it from some of the other thyroid-related syndromes, right? Like, I feel like many times people kind of screw this up with Sheehan syndrome and with pituitary apoplexy, right? So let me break it down. Let me give you some key unique differences. That'll help you differentiate those things. The first thing is, when a person has postpartum thyroiditis, it will present in the following way, right? It will present as a person that just recently delivered a child. And then the person will then have a hyperthyroid. So you see a temporal association with recent delivery of a baby. And then first, the person will have hyperthyroid symptoms. And then after that, the person will have hypothyroid symptoms. And then in most cases, that person's thyroid comes back online and then they become normal again, right? So you may say, Divine, what's the pathophysiology? Well, let's think about this for a second. The thing is, many of us know that when people are getting transplants, right, one of the things they have to get is immunosuppression because they are bringing in a foreign organ, right? If you bring in a foreign organ, well, it's not going to be a perfect match for you. So your body's immune system is like, this doesn't look right. Let's go ahead and destroy it. So that's why you usually suppress the immune system when you're taking, when you're getting an organ transplant, right? Now, kind of like the same thing with a baby, right? A baby is essentially, in a sense, a foreign organism in relation to the woman that is carrying said baby, right? So the thing is, naturally, the body actually immunosuppresses a pregnant woman. so that that woman's immune system is not primed to start attacking the baby, right? So in a person that has certain genetic susceptibilities, so let's say, for example, it's a woman that has like an autoimmune disease at baseline, right? So they can give you a person that has a history of like type 1 diabetes, or a person that has a history of vitiligo, a person that has a history of Addison's or Graves' disease, right? Or Hashimoto's thyroiditis, right? When a person is genetically susceptible to like an overactive immune system, after that child is born, then the immune system is like, okay, you've suppressed us for a couple of months. Now it's time for us to get back to our very strong attacking foreign organisms ways or whatever, right? So those people, they generate very powerful immunity, and that immunity begins to destroy the person's thyroid gland, right? Well, we know that the thyroid gland does not just make thyroid hormone. It also stores thyroid hormone. So that thyroid hormone that has been stored is released, right? It's almost sort of similar to the pathophysiology behind subacute thyroiditis, which, you know, your friends at the NBME also call de Quervain's thyroiditis or granulomatous thyroiditis, right? So the thing that's going to happen in those circumstances is that inflammation will release that preformed thyroid hormone. So the person will go through a thyrotoxic state, right? Person will go through a thyrotoxic state. So you release all that preformed thyroid hormone. When you finish up all that preformed thyroid hormone that was stored, you get all those hyperthyroid symptoms. Then remember, all that inflammation will burn out the person's thyroid gland. When you burn out the person's thyroid gland, the person's thyroid gland is not going to be working anymore, right? And because it's not working anymore, the person will become hypothyroid, right? But you know, after a few months, the immune system kind of comes back to its senses and is like, you know what? Let's not destroy this. Let's stop this thing. There's no more thyroid to destroy. And then the person's thyroid comes back online, right? And the person becomes euthyroid, right? The person becomes euthyroid. So that's actually a very high yield progression to know. That's actually the same progression that is followed by people that have de Quervain's thyroiditis on NBME exams. Okay, so now, but in the Quervain's thyroiditis, right, obviously, the person is going to have an exquisitely tender thyroid gland, and there will not be a temporal association with recent delivery of a child, right? So that's the thing that will help you differentiate that, right? So how do you not mess this up with Sheehan syndrome, for example? Well, again, remember, Sheehan syndrome, I always think of it as an ischemic stroke of a person's pituitary gland. So what do I mean by that? Well, if you think about it, when you get pregnant, right, especially for the women listening to this that have gotten pregnant or are currently pregnant, right, there's all these hormones flying all over the place. Well, guess what? Those hormones, they don't just come from thin air. They come from like an actual place, right? In this case, it's the anterior pituitary, right? So the thing is, your anterior pituitary gets really, really big during the process of pregnancy. It probably like doubles or more than doubles in size, if I'm remembering correctly. Right? So if that happens, you can essentially imagine that, oh wow, being an endocrine organ, remember, endocrine organs by definition require like copious amounts of blood supply, right? Endocrine organs require copious amounts of blood supply. So the thing is, if you get that, if you know your anterior pituitary gets big, you know, it's getting copious blood supply, then that means, because it's getting big and it's an endocrine organ and it needs a lot of blood, it's especially susceptible to loss of blood from the body, right? So if a woman, you know, God forbid, has like some bad pregnancy complication, like placenta previa, visa previa, abruptio placentae, or something of that sort. Although remember, in visa previa, it's the baby's blood that is coming out of the woman's vagina, not mom's blood. But essentially, if the woman bleeds a lot from, you know, like some really, really bad pregnancy complication, then that can cause like hypoperfusion of the person's anterior pituitary. And if you have hypoperfusion of the anterior pituitary, one unfortunate thing that's going to happen is that the person's anterior pituitary can infarct, right? And the classic presentation of that on NBM exams is that the person will have failure to lactate, right? They will have like many other signs of hypopituitarism as well, right? So they will have things like they'll have like hypothyroid symptoms. So notice they won't have any kind of hyperthyroid phase, right? That's one thing that will help you differentiate Sheehan syndrome from postpartum thyroiditis on NBM exams, right? So some people say, okay, Divine, how do I recognize Sheehan syndrome versus something like, pituitary apoplexy, right? The first thing that I think will help you with pituitary apoplexy is to remember that pituitary apoplexy is not going to have any kind of temporal association with recent delivery of a child on NBM exams. I'll say that again. Pituitary apoplexy is not going to have any kind of temporal association with delivery of a child on an NBM exam, right? So if you see that, right, if you see a recent delivery of a child, you should cross off pituitary apoplexy from consideration. So what causes pituitary apoplexy? What's the pathophase? Again, the thing that happens is, in this case, the inciting event is this person has a pituitary adenoma. Many times it's going to be a pituitary macroadenoma, big adenoma, right? So because it's a big adenoma, the unfortunate thing that can happen is that the person can, one of the blood vessels, because this macroadenoma is growing so quick, so fast, one of the blood vessels that is feeding the adenoma can pop. And if that blood vessel pops, it's almost like the person will have like a subarachnoid hemorrhage of that person's pituitary gland. Blood, right, free-flowing blood is very toxic to the pituitary gland. So that would destroy the person's pituitary, right? So the person's symptoms will be very sudden, right? For the most part, people that have postpartum thyroiditis or people that have Sheehan syndrome, their symptoms are very gradual. You know, it will take a couple of days, couple of weeks. But a person that has pituitary apoplexy, they will tell you that, oh, wow, 2 hours ago I was fine, and then boom, I had like this very severe headache. In fact, your friends at the NBM, they are very smart. They potentially give you something that kind of looks like a subarachnoid hemorrhagia presentation. Or they may tell you that the person said that, you know, like 3-4 days ago, I had a very severe headache, or like a week ago, I had a very severe headache. And then you now notice that days later, they are having signs and symptoms of hypopituitarism, right? If you see that, I really, really want you to think about pituitary apoplexy on NBM exams. And the thing is, you know, if your friends at the NBM are smart, which they are, they will give you a pituitary apoplexy question in a woman. It happens very commonly in men, but they definitely put it in a woman, right? Because they know that, again, people are especially prone once they see like thyroid-related anything, right? Or hypopituitarism-related anything in a woman, right? Even if the woman has not recently given birth, even the woman is in her 50s, for some bizarre reason, people will irrationally go after Sheehan syndrome, right? So that's something you want to be careful about on exams. Okay, now, what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that, oh, this patient, you know, is a TSA agent, and that he has had to call off sick from work for the last 2 weeks because he has been having just daily fevers, very severe low back pain, right? And they tell you that he's beginning to have like some bowel and bladder dysfunction, right? And then they give you some labs. You notice that his white blood cell count is 17,000, so it's elevated. And then you notice that it's like 80% lymphocytes. You're like, doesn't sound right. And then you also notice that, you know, this person is, again, this person has like suprapubic fullness, right? Again, telling you that he has a urinary retention, right? If you put all those things together, what should your diagnosis be? But I would really hope you're saying, oh, Divine, sounds like this guy has TB, right? So if you see a person that has potentially TB, right? Because again, TSA agent, you know, a lot of contact with people coming from many different countries, stuff like that, right? So you see something like that, right? You see a person that potentially has TB and you see they have back pain. What are you thinking about? Well, I hope you're saying that, oh, this person probably has TB osteomyelitis, right? Remember, these on NBM exams, occasionally this is what's called a Pott's disease, right? Pott's disease. So TB osteomyelitis, Pott's disease, right? Again, they can give you that presentation on exams. And again, it doesn't just always have to be in a TSA agent, right? People can get Pott's disease. They can get these TB-based sequelae if they have HIV, right? Because again, HIV immunocompromises a person, right? So if your CD4 positive T cells are not working, especially like your T helper 1 cells, your macrophages are not going to be particularly useful. So you're going to be having a lot of problems with TB infections, right? They can give this as a question in a person that is a military patient, right? So a person that is in the military. Again, right, many times the NBMEs, right, they write questions that are unique to the military, or they can write civilian questions, but they put a military person behind that, right? Or They can even give you like a person that is homeless. Again, many people are used to the classic presentation of the homeless, right? But another thing they can give you, like as a person that has TB, right? They can give you, like for example, a person that has one of these immunodeficiency diseases, and then they have Pott's disease, right? So again, that's just something I will encourage you to be really careful of on an MBM exam. The thing is, these days, again, many people are like, Divine, the exams are getting harder and harder and harder and harder. To be honest with you, don't get me wrong. Yes, I perfectly agree with you. The exams are getting harder. But other than the new material, right, that they are testing, right, which they clearly outline, right? They say, oh, you know, it was early last year. They said, oh, they're going to be testing a lot of stuff with people in the military, right? And they're going to be testing all these things about professionalism, communications, healthcare systems, and stuff. Every other thing that they are testing is pretty much stuff they've always tested in the past, right? But what do? These days, they give you like an unusual, it's still the same classic presentation, but they may give you like some unusual circumstances, right? So what do I mean by that? Because again, for example, many people are used to questions about TB relating to like some person that has HIV or a person that is homeless, right? But the thing is, again, those people are by definition immunocompromised in a sense, right? So what your friends at the MBM are doing these days is, oh, is there any way I can give you an immunocompromised person you're not very used to, right? That potentially has Pott's disease, for example, right? So they can give you, again, a person that has like Burton's gamma globulinemia. You'd be like, what? How does this person have TB, right? But again, if you really dig into it, this person has some kind of immunocompromise, right? So again, that's why it's very, in fact, if like from the course that I teach, the comprehensive course that I teach, I do a lot of stuff with giving people like unusual presentations of common disorders, right? Because again, those are things that the MBM kind of goes after these days on exams. Okay. So again, if a person has Pott's disease, obviously, how are you going to treat them? Well, I hope you're telling me that, oh, you're going to give them rifampin, isoniazid, pyrazinamide, ethambutol, right? And vitamin B6. Okay. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that this patient was recently started, this patient has a history of diabetes and he comes into the hospital and this patient has like, when he's coming to the hospital, he has like fevers, he's hypotensive, he has a big time leukocytosis, let's say his white count's like 20,000, right, and all that stuff. And then they say, they will give you like a list of his medications, and then they'll say, what is the next best step in management? But I hope you're saying, oh, Divine, we're going to go ahead and stop his metformin, right? In general, whenever a patient comes into the hospital, especially when they're sick, right? Because again, the MBM, they know that most people have memorized that, you know what? If a person is getting some kind of kidney-based imaging procedure, right? Or they're getting contrast, right? Something that can touch the kidneys, right? They know that, again, we live in an onky generation. Many people have memorized that, oh, you know, go ahead and stop the metformin so that these people don't get lactic acidosis and metformin toxicity, blah, 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 right? That's all well and good. But again, they are becoming more and more adept at putting these questions where they're not getting any kind of imaging, right? But they have some other unusual disorder that will preclude them from being on metformin, right? So for example, if a patient comes into the hospital and they're on metformin and they're septic, like this patient, you don't want to put them on that metformin. Because again, think about it, when you're septic at baseline, you're not perfusing your tissues very well, right? So you already have potentially some kind of lactic acidosis at baseline. If you have a lactic acidosis at baseline, then it makes no sense to be putting people on a drug that can potentially give them more lactic acidosis, right? So that's something you want to be careful about on exams. So that's one. Also, if people have liver dysfunction, right? If people have liver dysfunction, they should also not be on metformin. Why? Well, remember, the liver participates in something called the Cori cycle. So let me explain that real quick since I'm speaking largely to a step 2 CK, step 3 crowd here. Essentially, right, like when you're working out or whatever, and your muscles generate lactic acid. When you generate that lactic acid, your body is like, your muscles are like, okay, yeah, I need glucose. So what do? They send that lactic acid in a cycle called the Corey cycle to the liver. The liver will take that lactic acid and undergo the process of gluconeogenesis and remake that lactic acid back into glucose and ship it back to the muscle, right? So guess what? If your liver doesn't work well, you're going to short circuit that Corey cycle. So you're going to build up lactic acid. When you build up that lactic acid, right, it's not going to be good for you if you are taking metformin at the same time, right? Because again, you're going to have this bad lactic acidosis, right? And again, people may think lactic acidosis is not a big deal. No, it's a big deal because it can literally kill a person, right? So that's something you need to keep at the back of your mind for exams. Now, what if they give you a question about a child and they tell you that this child, has like a lot of bone pain, and especially like around the scalp, and then they tell you that they obtain imaging of the child's head, let's say like they get like a skull radiograph, and then you notice all these little like holes, like black holes, right? Almost like a lot of black holes, like almost like holes, like lytic lesions in the child's skull. What are you thinking about? Well, I hope you're saying, oh, Divine, this sounds an awful lot like Langerhans cell histiocytosis, right? Langerhans cell histiocytosis. Sometimes you may see it referred to, although it's kind of like an old term. It's called a eosinophilic granuloma, right? So they can ask you like, oh, what's the diagnosis, right? Again, obviously it'll be Langerhans cell histiocytosis, right? Or sometimes your friends at the MB media will ask you, oh, what's the likely finding on biopsy, right? So if you biopsy these lesions in the child's like skull, right, you would usually find like a bunch of lymphocytes, a bunch of eosinophils, right? And you'll find them in like a granulomatous infiltrate, right? That's why it's called eosinophilic granuloma. It's literally a granuloma that contains eosinophils. Because usually, right, if you're looking at a person's granuloma, the only thing you're going to find is epithelioid macrophages, right? So for example, let's say if a person has TB, right? If a person has TB and you biopsy like a TB lesion, you're going to see granulomas with a ton of macrophages. Macrophages are the primary thing you find in TB lesions, not lymphocytes, right? That's a common mistake people make on exams, right? So, but if you're looking at a granuloma and you're seeing lots and lots and lots of eosinophils, that should be getting you down the pathway of Langerhans cell histiocytosis, right? And again, remember, on electron microscopy, you'll find those tennis racket-shaped granules. Many times those things are called Birbeck granules on exams. So I think I'm going to go ahead and stop here. Again, I want to keep this short. But again, there were just some core concepts that I know lots of people struggle with that I wanted to get out in the form of vignettes and also try to really break down the pathophysiology for people. And as I do at the end of every podcast, again, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for many exams, step one, step two CK, step three, preclinical med school exams, third year shelf exams. And if you're a medicine resident, I tutor for the internal medicine in training exam and the internal medicine boards. But again, if you want me to tutor you, you need to reach out to me like well ahead of time. For the most part, my tutoring schedule is like typically booked like 3 to 4 weeks ahead because it's just literally that full 3 to 4 weeks ahead. So if you're interested in tutoring, reach out to me early. Don't wait till like the last minute, like, oh, Divine, I have an exam next week. I literally just cannot physically tutor you just because I literally don't have the time. Of course, I would love to help, but I just literally won't have the time, right? So if you're interested in tutoring, just reach out to me sooner rather than later. And then we'll just book out all the sessions like weeks in advance so that you get at least you're able to see me when you need to. And then again, if you can make that, again, one thing that many people have gotten a lot of benefit from, as I've said, these are group courses, the 20-hour Step 2 CK Step 3 course and the MBME Test Taking Strategies course. Again, many people have done that alone and they've gotten lots and lots of good benefits from that. And then these podcasts are on, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify. So if you subscribe to those podcast apps and you subscribe to the podcast itself, you'll get it in your feed. You'll get the most recent 150 podcasts is a WordPress role. There's literally no way around it. I've explored many different mechanisms. So if you want everything from episode one, you need to literally go on the website, divineinterventionpodcasts.com, and you'll get it from there. And the thing about the website is If you subscribe to the actual website itself, you will get like an email notification whenever I make a new podcast. And then I also have a YouTube channel, Divine Intervention, USMLE Podcasts and Videos. That's where I put a lot of my videos. So I hope you found this podcast to be helpful. Thank you for listening. I will see you next time. God bless you. Have a wonderful day and keep the flag flying.